Hi, I'm Catherine Mangu-Ward. I'm the managing editor of Reason Magazine, and I'm here with Mark Schmidt, the New America Foundation, and we are going to talk about email security and racists in Oklahoma and probably some other exciting topics. Thanks for talking with me, Mark.
Thank you, Catherine. I've enjoyed doing this, you know, every few months lately.
Yep, absolutely. So, topic of the day, Hillary Clinton, her email, her desire not to carry two phones, or perhaps to secretly carry two phones, or perhaps to carry two phones and three email accounts allocated in a random way so as to trick spies. What's your take on this for 2016 and also just in general for how we should all make our own personal technology choices?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of blown my mind. I mean, I've been very comfortable with Hillary Clinton as a candidate. I felt like, I'm one of those people who the most, you know, I lived through the 90s. I was frustrated by kind of the messiness of Clinton stuff. I was kind of turned off by the messiness of the 2008 Clinton campaign. But I felt like everything since then has been, you know, by the book, how you do things. So it sort of astonished me when it first came out. I mean, to me, just like having two emails is pretty basic. I remember, you know, years ago, maybe 12 years ago, hearing a story in the place I was working at the time about somebody who, you know, because there had been a lawsuit, somebody's whole, you know, entire email had been basically subpoenaed, and, you know, as a result, all kinds of stuff about an affair the person was having was on the email. So it was, you know, a reminder that, you know, there you have to, you know, put your personal stuff here and your business stuff here, even if you're not a government official. And most people I know, I think, do that at this point. I probably do more on my personal than I should, but most things, if it's really, you know, a New America business thing, I do it from my New America address. That just seems to be how you live in the world in the 21st century. So it kind of surprised me. It's also surprising that the whole thing just goes on and on. And that, to me, is always the thing about politics. It's not like what's the, you know, definitive thing about the scandal, the, you know, the smoking gun. It's just how long things drag out. So, like, I always think that, you know, the problem with Chris Christie is that the Bridgegate stuff, it will continue for a pretty long period of time, even if we never get to the point where there's the memo from Chris Christie that says shut down that bridge. Nothing happened here of the same type of scale, but the length of time is kind of astonishing, and then the number of new questions that are raised by the press conference, like what was the process for picking the things to be deleted? I mean, it's just a really bizarre kind of self-inflicted problem, and you know, it's not a thing in itself; it really isn't. But it kind of adds a dimension to any other thing that gets cooked up about Secretary Clinton. I mean, Benghazi was nothing, but now it's still the question of, you know, what was in those emails that we haven't seen. And, you know, who needs that? You just have two email addresses. It's what everybody does. I don't get it.
I think the moment that I kind of shared your instinct at first, like, oh, God, this is just like a, you know, it's a warm-up scandal for 2016. It's not a big deal. Like, she made a dumb tech decision, whatever. But yesterday after the press conference, Ryan Lizza said basically like, oh, I didn't think this was a thing, but now maybe it's a thing. And I was like, oh, okay, now it's a thing. I think that's kind of the attitude that I got generally from people, was that the press conference was a reminder of why people hated the Clintons when they left office. I think we kind of had enough time. It's like, you know, you break up with your boyfriend and you kind of don't see him for a while and you remember the good things. And then like, you get back in touch and you're like, oh no, you're kind of an asshole. I remember now. And it's like, I think we're just having that moment with the Clintons. Yeah. Like they're back, they're in our lives again. And you're like, yeah, you think you're better than us and you don't have to follow the rules. And I think that,
I mean,
basically all politicians think that about themselves by and large, but the Clintons have kind of elevated it to an art form.
Well, I guess so. I mean, people tend to put it in that kind of moral tone of, you know, you think you're better than other people and don't have followers. I don't really see it that way, and I didn't hate the Clintons, although I was definitely, you know, ready for a change and kind of come from the faction of Democrats that wasn't fully the Clinton faction. That, you know, I worked for Bill Bradley, who ran against Gore in 2000, so kind of looking for something else. But it was that it was that it's that pervasive sense of carelessness and mess that I don't think is just, you know, think they're better than I think the rules don't apply. It's like just, I mean, they do apply, and they come, and the rules come and kick them in the butt. There's a kind of carelessness that, you know, I just never associate. We get that carelessness with Bill Clinton, you know. I mean, I think we always felt like, you know, as a partnership, part of what made it a good partnership is one is all energy and, you know, chaos and, you know, sort of it, I guess. And the other is, the other one disciplines and, you know, Bill Clinton probably wouldn't have been president if he didn't have the partnership with the more disciplined, strategic Hillary. And I just never kind of expect that kind of chaos out of Hillary Clinton. And you saw it in 2008, and then you see it again. It's just really a
carelessness. I see that interpretation, but I also think, like, it's not an act of carelessness to set up an entire homebrew email server and, like, knowingly violate State Department protocol in using that server to conduct your business. I mean, that's like, it's not like, whoops, I, like, reinvented the wheel on email. I'm just so careless. I mean, it was a carefully thought out something that was not thought out correctly.
I guess something. But, I mean, I get the, you know, before you're Secretary of State, you're in this interim period. I get that, for example, for President Clinton, I think IT people would tell you it's safer to have, you know, your own thing and your own server. I mean, I've
particularly
heard
if you have, like, the physical security of the Secret Service around that
something
server.
Like that.
I think that
something
is a
like
good
that.
Point that
I
she
mean,
made.
I think,
right?
I think it's wrong. I mean, I think in fact you're probably safer on Gmail than on anything else. But maybe with the protection of the Secret Service. So I think that basic decision, you know, kind of makes sense. The thing that bothers me is, why wouldn't you have, you're still going to lapse over, and some things that you're doing in your private space might be considered official. But, you know, just try to separate, because then you save yourself the trouble of then trying to separate out, you know, 60,000 emails or whatever it is, you know, 6 years later. If I told somebody to go through all my email and separate what's official from what's personal,
it would be a mess.
It would take 6 months. It would be ridiculous, and they'd screw it up. You know, it's just easier to make that choice at the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, the other element I think that has come out of this micro scandal, mini scandal, whatever it is, something that we rediscover periodically, which is how out of touch politicians are with the way that the rest of the world conducts business, right? We've had Lindsey Graham saying, oh, I've never sent an email, this one time, I can't really remember. And Bill Clinton apparently doesn't use email.
Right.
It's easy to kind of make a joke about it and say, like, oh, how can you, you know, have regulatory responsibility for these things? And, if you're not an email user, and, like, I think that's probably overblown, but I do think it's a reminder of the kind of rarefied world that particularly, you know, long timers, right, like lifers in DC, can live in. And it's also a reminder of how kind of tightly sealed a vault these people can live in, right? Like, I get crazy emails all the time because my email address is online, right? Like, I'm not saying that this is, like, a great window into the American psyche, but it does.
And you operate in a universe that has some nutty people in it.
Right. I mean, you know, there's lots of inputs, and they come into me, they come directly to me, and the idea that people are communicating on the Hill and in the White House and in the State Department in ways that are so radically different from how every other professional American communicates is upsetting, right?
But I mean, I don't know if it's upsetting. I mean, I'm sure that's true for CEOs and people like that too. I mean, especially Lindsey Graham is surprising because he's not quite that old, but, you know, there's a kind of generational line right about the time of the Clintons where, you know, people, you know, when Hillary Clinton went to work in a law firm, you know, there was probably no lawyer who actually knew how to type. You know, they all just like, they either dictate or they scribble something and they had somebody who would take care of it for them. Every one of these people has like a person who's basically there 24 hours handing them pieces of paper and, you know, back and forth. And that's I actually couldn't function like that. It just seems bizarre to not be like typing and engaged and directly responding to things. But it's a whole different mode of work, you know, that the kind of, I always think I'm like on the cusp of men who can type, or, you know, seriously. Men 20 years older than me cannot type.
Right. I mean, it was at one point a specialized skill, right? You had to hire someone who had the skill to do this thing for you. But, you know, I think the sort of difference, and this may also be something about the pace of change in government versus the pace of change in private industry. Every lawyer now sends email. Now, they maybe don't send email as much as other professions, but, you know, everything is becoming increasingly automated, and in the private sector, that trend is so much faster, whereas in government, partially because of, unions and the idea that some jobs that are maybe now semi-irrelevant are protected, and so people might as well use those functions, like secretaries, but also this sort of, you know, as much as everybody pays lip service to transparency, this desire to keep things off the record and undiscoverable for the future.
Well, that's what's interesting to me, and I've been kind of engaged with this question about transparency, totally separate from Hillary Clinton. I have a piece that came out in Democracy Journal yesterday that touches on that and some other things that we'll link to. I won't get too deeply into it, but one of the responses that you see a lot to yesterday is like, it's not up to you to decide. I keep seeing this line: those are our emails, Madam Secretary. You know, they all belong to the taxpayer, and we have a right to know what's in those emails. Well, you know, we often lapse into this, you know, the over really broad view of transparency is like, we want to know everything that goes on in government and we'll figure it out. Obviously, lots of things should happen in basically a private space. I mean, and it doesn't have to be classified, but like people in the State Department should have a right to kind of think among themselves about what they think the right response is to something, including maybe raising some really bad ideas that you don't want, you know, if you don't want it to come out that, you know, such and such Assistant Secretary of State raised the stupidest, most offensive idea ever.
We do have this elaborate process for how we determine which things belong to the taxpayers and which things are appropriately private, right? Like the whole objection to the Hillary situation is like, you know, do you not care that we've like built over decades these systems for determining, what's personal, what's private, what's classified, what's public. You know, I'm not saying the FOIA process is anywhere near perfect, obviously, but, you know, the idea that it's like, I appreciate that we have this elaborate precedent for how we make all these decisions.
You can go
eat a bag. I'm doing it my way. You know, that's the concern.
I think that's right. Although I also think that, you know, it's unsurprising. I mean, I've never been a journalist who did FOIA as my mode of operation, but I know that, you know, people don't expect to get everything. You know, it's unsurprising to get we have nothing on that kind of response to a FOIA. It's all taken pretty casually. It's not a well-oiled system. I mean, and obviously not, you know, exempting yourself from it completely is not the right approach. Even if you can't, even if in the end we assume that, you know, all of the 55,000 pages of email, you know, that line has in fact been drawn, and now that they've been separated and the business, the official email has been put where it belongs.
Can we talk about that number for a minute? So she keeps saying, I've released 55,000 pages of emails, as if like, oh my God, we should really appreciate
I know.
How much she's handed over. And I think about my inbox and I'm like, like 55,000 pages seems like that's what I sent last week.
Pages is not 55,000 emails, because, you know, when an email has a bunch of CC.
It's all the previous chain printed out again and again.
Yeah. I saw a number like 36,000 emails in that. I read just a little bit of there's like a 9-page explainer that the Clinton people put out, and that had a different number. That had the number 36,000 in it, I think. But still, yeah.
But like, I mean, I'm just thinking like if I searched the word like robots in my Gmail box, I feel like I could get 55,000 pages.
Yeah. I mean, God, no. I mean, I'm always in shock. You know, I'm in awe of people who have the zero inbox thing because, you know, I see 8,000 unread emails, and some of those are, you know, they're woot.com or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, everybody uses it differently. I don't know.
So let's kind of talk about the flip side of the digital privacy thing, which is when everything is online, including videos that your fraternity makes of a bus ride where everyone is saying the N word in song in black tie. This is like in what I think is like a pretty bizarre week. Apparently our two stories are Hillary Clinton's email privacy. And it turns out in 2015 at the University of Oklahoma, there are just like a bunch of people who are super, super racist and have like an institution devoted to that, which I mean, am I naive that that's kind of blowing my mind? Like, these are 18-year-olds in 2015. What? I mean, it's like I know that's a very articulate response, but that's almost all I can come up with. Is like,
yeah.
You know,
well, I think your response.
This seems like something that could happen 50 years ago.
Well, I know about it. I haven't actually watched the video, so.
Right. I mean, but the video itself is. Yeah, I mean, the video itself is definitely, I think part of it is, you know, because it's a, you know, it's been sort of disseminated in Vine format. Like, it's this very short little clip, which is apparently how the kids these days communicate, right? Your Snapchats and your Vines and on the internets with the Facebooks. But I guess now Facebook is actually even for old people. But it's enough. I mean, that's actually something that is you know... politicians, right, are always saying, oh, my remarks were taken out of context, and maybe that's often the case. But here it's like there's really no context where a bunch of young white men on a bus in black ties singing about how they hate niggers is okay, right? So what do we, like, what do we make of this? And in particular, you know, I think, you know, I hate to be in this position because these guys are just so appalling, but I think the constitutional argument here is really interesting. Like, I think it's not constitutional for the university to expel these guys. It's speech in a public institution. I mean, what's your take on that?
I mean, I think that's probably right. I mean, I've been, you know, Eugene Volokh made that point, and I've been, you know, I've had a couple of conversations about that. I think it's a, I feel like a lot of people start their statements by saying, I'm a First Amendment absolutist, but. Which sometimes reminds me of when people say, you know, there's not a racist bone in my body, but, you know, like if you're a First Amendment absolutist, you be a First Amendment absolutist. And I don't call myself that, but I do think that you need to, you know, you need to really confront the hardest case to really see where your commitment to free expression, you know, is. And I mean, this is probably This is probably about the hardest case. I mean, people often present things that they seem like hard cases, but they really aren't for that individual. Such a hard case. I think that so probably the answer is that they shouldn't be expelled just for that expression. I'm sort of tempted by saying, you know, they probably shouldn't be. But you know what? If the university wants to say you're expelled, and they don't they realize that they have no moral standing to challenge that, so they're not going to kind of make the case for themselves. Maybe I'm sort of okay with that. It's kind of like somebody says, well, what if they were expelled for, you know, singing the the Internationale or whatever, you know, singing communist folk songs or something like that. Well, you know, if they were expelled for that, they would challenge it and they would win, but you know, if they're doing something that they themselves know is sort of disgraceful, beyond disgraceful, then I guess I'm a little less worried about the expulsion. I mean, it's certainly not like their being expelled in itself isn't, you know, it's not like the worst thing that happened in America this week.
Well, I guess
not even in the top 10.
I can agree with you about that, but I do think, you know, like the mechanism that you're proposing here, which is basically like sufficient internal shame, is to like minimize the challenge in a case like this. Like, that doesn't seem to me like a great system to kind of deal with these kind of situations going forward. I mean,
not to go full
like reductio ad libertarian here, but I think one thing that's worth noting is the fraternity, right? The national organization for the fraternity almost certainly will, and perhaps already has, expel this chapter from their organization, right? So already the fraternity doesn't exist, essentially.
And I think the university kicked the chapter off also. But, you know, I actually have a problem.
But I think the other element is that a private university could expel these students without having a constitutional problem, right? So, you know, I'm not saying this is the
constitutional problem. Yeah.
I'm not saying this is the definitive case against public universities. Clearly, there's like a huge kind of complex web of cost-benefit analysis to be done. But at the same time, it's like, if you are uncomfortable with a scenario in which you have to choose between the First Amendment and like expelling these pieces of shit, you know, a solution that presents itself is like, oh, maybe this is why we should be nervous about having public institutions do things that have all these other functions, including like teaching 18-year-olds how to be humans, which is like a complex task. So what do you think about that? Like this idea that the problem, at least in part, is the weird kind of Frankenstein monster of public universities.
Yeah, no, I'm not going reductio ad libertarium on that. I mean, there are rights that students have even in public institutions, even in private institutions. I don't know exactly the legal ramifications in a private institution. I mean, there are a lot of public spaces, whether they're public universities, public parks, public employees. Public employee
in all those spaces, people can say these things. And we're generally comfortable with the fact that people can say stuff like this on a street corner because, God damn it, the First Amendment. But we're less comfortable with the idea that someone who's still in at least a quasi kind of in loco parentis situation, that there's no real mode of discipline available. Whereas there is a mode of discipline available if it's a private institution.
I guess, I mean, it's a funny point you're getting to where you're essentially saying that because there's a public institution, we have less ability to restrict speech than if we didn't have these public institutions. But as a libertarian, you want to be in the space where you're for protecting speech, right?
Well, no, I mean, I actually think like this is kind of like a common misconception, right? Libertarians don't dislike rules, they dislike rules that are impossible to opt out of. They dislike rules that are, you know, to go totally exaggerated, enforced at the point of a gun. And so, you know, I think it's great. If anything, I favor more situations where we use social censure or, you know, private property or, the kind of sort of additional elements that we can kind of use to put pressure on people or sanction them that are only available to private players. Reason Magazine doesn't have to publish hate speech, and we don't, and we feel strongly about not doing that, precisely because we are a private institution. Whereas a street corner, you got to let anybody say what they want there. I think the idea that we could have lots of places where we have different rules about who says what is a much better outcome than maximum number of places where anyone can say anything.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, I have to think. That's kind of a lot to take in, because in a way you're saying that the fact that the public institution has fewer rules is a problem. Although and you can still do lots of, there can be lots of social censure, there can be lots of other things that happen in a public institution.
Sure, I mean, they, but I think I mean, the, this is a great.
The institution kicked the frat out, and I'm not happy with the the idea of saying, well, the problem is solved because the National Fraternal Organization kicked out that chapter. I don't know that much about. I know nothing about that frat. I know it's a very old line Southern frat, and that is a song that seems to be about the frat as a whole. So, is there any reason to think that other chapters don't sing the same song? I don't know. But when they take action like that, it's kind of like, the action is don't get caught. And maybe nobody will sing the song in the future, but it doesn't sound like they made it up on the bus,
That's still, I think the idea that there's going to be, there's someone somewhere has to say, this isn't allowed. And as far as I'm concerned, it is not constitutional for the University of Oklahoma to be that someone. Right. So then who should that someone be? And I think the solution is, okay, well, first the National Fraternal Organization, that's a good place to start. But also again, if that kind of speech had happened in, a private restaurant, right? If those guys had been in a restaurant and they had been singing that song, you want the restaurant owner to be able to say, get out, I'm not serving you your hamburgers, and you want airway people who own a television station or people who own a podcast. If somebody says something like that, you want them to be able to be like, this interview is over, get out. And that's something that we have established as what, something that a private entity can do that we can't do in a public
But space. It's something a private entity can do, but it's not something that a private entity must do. So you might well have a restaurant
but
there.
But we're not, singing, we can't and
the
get to must.
Hey, the owner's singing along, And when you get to the public-private, it's also important to know that when you think about the consequences of racial attitudes, we only have integrated institutions in the South because public institutions integrated first. I mean, we were able, as a matter of public policy, to force there to be integrated institutions of higher education, which would not have happened if there were only Alabama and Auburn. If there was only the private institutions. If there were only the private institutions in the South, we wouldn't have higher education in integrated settings for African American students.
Which is a bigger deal than some
assholes saying the N-word.
Right. I mean, I certainly don't want to go back and do a alternate history of racism in the South. But I think we wouldn't have integrated institutions in the South is pretty clearly not true. Right. I mean, there were many, many other cultural forces at work besides just decisions at the state level to integrate public universities. And I think it's clearly what you're not saying is, in the absence of state force to integrate public universities in the South, all the universities in the South would still be segregated. There would be, private institutions had already were already moving that direction.
Somewhere. In Amory.
Places,
and
right. So,
yeah, yeah.
So I certainly think you can argue about when it happens, how fast it happens, but
right. I don't know the institution.
It's not as if public institutions are the only force for good here.
In Oklahoma, for example, but I mean, there are lots of things. There are lots of things that public colleges and universities have done for this country. I mean, it's one of those great American achievements with the land grant, the Morrill Act, and the land grant colleges, and basically creating avenues for people to to get higher education at different times of their lives and things like that. Things that the private world wasn't quite doing. I mean, it's something we should be incredibly proud of. What's the alternate history where we have no public institutions of higher education in this country? I don't know what that looks like, because it goes, you have to roll the clock back a very long way. But I think it's a pretty, I think to sort of denigrate that whole concept based on this video,
a lot of
achievement in this country.
And what I said at the beginning was, I'm not saying this means abolish all private colleges, or all public colleges. I don't think that's the logical conclusion of what happened here. But I do think, it really is true that, this happened at a public institution, and we now are, not in a position to have good tools for that institution to deal with this. And what they've just done to deal with it is unconstitutional and will almost certainly not be upheld by courts. And I think it will be challenged.
You know, so, I kind of think of
so
it. So
it's worth thinking about. It's a place that we get put into where our gut says bad.
Yeah. I mean, I think of my like, weird. I know my solution is kind of a bad one, which is to say, I'm expelling you, bring it on. But it reminds me a little bit, I think Jack Goldsmith and some other people have a way of talking about presidential actions, like, whether it's secrecy or other kinds of unilateral presidential actions, where it's to sort of say, you know, it actually is unconstitutional, but there are moments when the president just should do that thing, knowing that it's so clear cut that the public and legislators and everybody will kind of recognize that the state of emergency was so great that that action was necessary. But we're not going to try to carve out a legal space for it because the legal space will be abused. And now that's a weird way. It's a weird way of saying there are times when you actually want to break that rule. There are times when it's justified to break that rule. I think there are times when I think this is a case where you say, you know, that speech is kind of protected, but if David Boren is the president of the University of Oklahoma, wants to cross that line and say, bring it on, I think that's okay. And those students aren't going, you know, hopefully they have enough shame that they're not going to try to go into a court and say, yeah, we had the right to sing that song.
You are killing me. This is the worst thing I've ever heard. I mean, the idea that, like, it's rule of law, not rule of men. It's, you know, we can't, like, the idea that
but
it's
you,
like,
but
well,
you're the
someone,
one who's saying,
you, but you're
but
saying,
you're the one who's saying
you're,
it should be
you're
norms.
Saying
it,
the
should
pre-
be, it should be social norms, not rules. And this is a way of saying something.
No,
like
I'm saying that when it is a case of action by the state, which is what this is, because it's a public university, that it absolutely has to be governed by law, that it's rule of law, not rule of men, that there's a clear-cut legal commandment here to the University of Oklahoma, and by the way, also to the president in the kind of cases that you're describing, and that, you know, the solution is not, okay, well, we'll just let everybody violate this in an ad hoc way when they're doing the right thing. You know, but if they're doing the wrong thing, they probably won't do it, or maybe it won't stand up to challenge. Like, that's a terrible system. The system should be, we take as much as possible out of the public realm and move it into private institutions where there are much better mechanisms to deal with these things.
Okay, but unless you want to stand by the view that there should be no public institutions of higher education, you're not getting rid of this problem. And you don't.
That's definitely my view writ large. I don't think that this incident is enough to convince you or probably most people that that's true. But I still think it's worth saying the fact that people who support the existence of these institutions don't really have a satisfactory response to what to do about this sort of thing should make those people rethink their stance. And your, like, ad hoc, it's okay to violate the rules when you agree with me solution is not a good one.
Right. I think it's my position is it's kind of okay to violate the rules in the most extreme situation. And I think, you know, my world is the consequences of my view of the world are a lot less severe than the consequences of your view of the world.
I mean, the president is droning American citizens without permission, right? Your view of the world is like, people in power can make ad hoc decisions and then they have to live with the consequences, right? But people in power make irreversible ad hoc decisions all the time that are absolutely terrible, which is why we demand that our presidents and legislatures and governors and heads of universities be bound by the law.
Right. I just think I feel like I'm opening up a separate kettle of worms here, which is a dangerous one. I think that there are, you know, once in a thousand years, there are situations where you get that profound conflict between the rule of law and the thing that you must do.
I think it's,
and
like once in a thousand minutes.
Do, which is,
I think it's like every day you have that conflict.
Well, you have a more complicated life than I do, but
I mean, not me personally, but in the world, in the world,
yeah, in
you
the
know,
world.
It,
those, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
If that kind of conflict was happening to me every day, I would indeed be living a truly interesting and complicated life.
Right.
But luckily,
but people, but right, but also people, you know, every time you light a joint or whatever, you are choosing to not follow the rule of law. You're right. choosing to do something so then, that you think is just fine by your own morality, and that's fine too.
So first, I want to ask you, why must you use this light a joint example with me, your local libertarian? Second,
because it's the only crime I personally feel like committing myself, you know.
But also, this is I think that kind of example makes my point, which is like clearly that's a decision where we say, you know, we should let individuals make that decision. We should let people privately make that decision. So let's take it out of the realm. Let's take it out of the public realm. Let's take it out of the realm of the state. Right. And I think that's true in lots of cases.
Right. But until that's done, which, you know, where we live, it has been done, so it doesn't really matter. But you know, until that's done, it's still a choice between the rule and an action.
Right. But I don't get to then make the case that, like, well, I had a special justification because of executive power, right? I mean, that's the difference.
When the president does it, the president isn't making a special justification, and the president is just saying, you know, you make your own, you know, impeach me if you want, because it was a violation.
But there's this, like, gigantic gray area, right, of, like, non-impeachable yet clearly appalling behavior, for instance, not having, you know, followed State Department email protocol.
Right. But I'm not talking about the appalling non-impeachable. I'm talking about the actual thing that would be impeachable unless everybody kind of said, you know what, I get why he had to do that.
Well, the idea that we're gonna let all of this happen post hoc strikes me as rather alarming. But we will
probably There are no great solutions to this. These guys actually are protected by the First Amendment. They're terrible. It's probably not the end of the world that they're protected by the First Amendment.
I guess I agree with that. We can end on that note. So let's talk a little bit about the White House is proposing changing the rules for student debt forgiveness and also some of the other regulations around how students interact with the makers of student loans. So, I mean, what do you think about that?
I was eavesdropping on my colleagues at New America. I sit right next to our education program, and they were just having a loud argument about some of those issues. So I'm trying to glean to borrow some insight.
give us the Cliff's Notes. What should we think?
I think bankruptcy is, I kind of came to understand this sometime in the last, you know, around the time of the financial crisis. Bankruptcy is a really, really important tool in the sort of second chance economy. In the way, in kind of the American dream is not just you move up and up and up. The American dream to me is in part like you don't have one move that brings you all the way to the bottom. You know, you have way to be able to take risks. You have to have protections, and those protections could be things like unemployment insurance, but it's also that opportunity to kind of get a fresh start without being weighed down by bad choices. It can be just, you know, you graduated from college in 2008, and that's, you know, and you were really stuck for a number of years. So bankruptcy protection, the idea that one of the few things that's not dischargeable in bankruptcy is student loans is kind of astonishing. Partly because it's one of the few things that people have. I mean, we know people make dumb choices about them. We know there's a lot of coercion about them. There's a lot of people who end up with loans with no benefit at all because they don't actually complete or aren't able to complete the program. So discharging student loans in bankruptcy has always seemed a really important a move. Now, this is an interesting step because this, you know, we've seen a real expansion of this private loan market, which is where people are borrowing above and beyond what they're eligible for in the public system. I think as there's been kind of some cracking down on the public loans, a lot of the proprietary schools, for example, have increasingly encouraged people to take private loans. Again, those programs are often the programs that people don't complete, so they actually don't have the income to pay off those loans. You know, it seems to me kind of a no-brainer. That, you know, even if even things like child support get suggested in the case of bankruptcy, that student loans is still the one thing where, you know, the creditor is guaranteed. I mean, it seems fantastic to me. Catherine?
Sorry, you just cut out for a second. Yeah, I think all that's true. I guess, to me, one of the big questions is just, like, how does this impact people's decision-making? And all of these problems you just described with people who are taking out loans that don't make good sense for a variety of reasons, that aren't kind of a reasonable financial bet. I guess, to me, the big question is, like, okay, if we make it easier to discharge those loans in bankruptcy, and I agree with you that it's a weird historical artifact that they can't be right now, but is this going to make people more or less rational in their loan-taking behavior? And it seems pretty clear to me the answer is that it's going to make them less rational, that people are going to take out more loans, and that right now we're in a situation where people are already taking out too many loans. I mean,
I don't think people, you know, make decisions saying, you know, if this doesn't work out, I'll just declare bankruptcy. I mean, I think there's a certain kind of, you know, Florida real estate businessman type who, you know,
that's true, but at the same time,
bankruptcy every 3 years. But most people, that's a you know, it's worse, more excruciating than divorce or anything else you can go through. It's an excruciating process that people don't take lightly, I think.
That's true, but at the same time, it doesn't matter if individuals are thinking explicitly about the possibility of bankruptcy, right? Like, the whole system is affected by this possibility of bankruptcy, and it means that individual academic institutions, which generally tend to play a role in determining the amount that students are encouraged to take, will be more liberal in their encouragement. It means that banks will have a different, I mean, now the federal government obviously is the major maker of student loans at this point, but private banks will have different standards for how they handle those loans. And that actually, in theory, will be improved.
Well,
right?
the lenders here are different. Right. The lenders are like Sally Mae, which is now.
Right. I mean, there's
a
whole
servicer.
There's sort of different tiers that, I mean, most people are inhabiting a very a highly regulated tier. But the idea that, I mean, it's just very clear to me that the problem right now is not, like, there aren't enough people taking the kind of risk that we want to encourage to take out a loan so they can get an education. It's the other way. People are taking too many risks and then getting screwed. And now they will take more risks and possibly be less screwed in the long run. But that it's like,
right,
bad overall for the financial system and for the continued,
right,
health of the loan industry and, like, the federal government's bottom line.
Right, right, right. And it's, you know, and there are places that have, I mean, there's a, my friend Monica Potts wrote a story the other day about this, you know, a bunch of people had huge loans from Corinthian colleges, which then went out of business. So they got, you know, no education, a lot of debt, and there's an effort to do a kind of a debt strike for them. There's no question that bankruptcy, just making student loans dischargeable in bankruptcy is create some problems along with the solution, but it's not like it's the only thing the Obama administration is doing on student loans. I worked on student loans, you know, 20 years ago when I worked on the Hill, and we were just beginning to try to put together the pieces of direct lending, and there was very little progress. And to me, I look at the administration, they've just tried to do, and it's very, you know, you always say one of the toughest lobbies in Washington is what's called One DuPont Circle, where all the higher education organizations,
yeah,
are. And it's very, very resistant to change. And the bigger private colleges and state colleges often, you know, insist on policies that actually continue to protect some of the abusive, even though they aren't themselves the abusive private institutions. There's a lot going on. But for example, the Obama administration proposed a kind of scorecard or ranking of colleges based on their ability to, you know, so that people can look at that and make a judgment about whether this program is actually going to lead to higher income or not. Everybody went bananas over that. You know, there was the gainful employment rule, which I guess has now been somewhat implemented around student loans, that prevented some of the real abuses, again, making sure that people are actually able to get employment after they come out of the program. I mean, there's just like a ton of things that the administration has done. They've also done a lot of income contingent repayment, and again, that's all on the federal side. Some of which, you know, creates a very different climate for loans than just a few years ago. So, you know, if you look at the whole of the changes in student loans, to me it's been an incredibly positive period, although there's a vast amount more to do. And people, even if leaving bankruptcy out of it, it's very hard for people. I mean, it's very hard for 18-year-olds, but you're also talking about people who are, you know, older and making choices about how to fit education into their into other aspects of their life and what's gonna matter and what's not. I mean, people are really flying blind. I mean,
right?
You know,
but I mean,
there's
that's
kind of an
this
assumption
is why,
like, if you add something, you're gonna get more income, and people don't really know what that is. And if it happened, you know, if you happen to do that in the middle of a recession, you're not gonna get more income.
Right. I mean, I think the issue here, though, is of course individuals don't have a lot of experience in making these kinds of decisions, but individuals don't have a lot of experience in making lots of kinds of decisions, and they let price signals guide them, right? So in this case, I think what we're seeing is that we're moving farther and farther from a place where people have any sense of the actual cost of a loan, right? Or the expected benefit from that loan. And the way that you would know if something, and of course the mortgage crisis, you know, puts the lie to this to a certain extent, but it still functions extremely well in almost all other parts of the economy, which is like, if a bank won't give you a loan to make a purchase or pursue an activity, it's because the bank, which is way better at telling these things, doesn't think you can pay that loan back. And right now we have a system that's almost completely separated giving education loans from any expectation about whether or not those loans can be paid back. And you're right that we made some strides in that direction. But, the idea that making these kind of tweaks or ranking schools and then adding this bankruptcy situation, the idea that that moves us toward a system of more rational loan making and taking, I'm not seeing it.
Well, you know, and the flip side of it is, of course, in the old system where you had the banks making the guaranteed loans, they had no incentive to not make a loan
because they were being guaranteed by the Fed. And
they basically sell the loan. They'd sell the loan upstream to Sally Mae or one of the other organizations.
But the problem isn't the sale. The problem isn't the sales upstream. But the problem is the federal guarantee, right? The federal guarantee
makes banks act irrationally. Right. But so on the private loan side, which is now these, you know, the new version of Sally Mae and other things, on the private loan side, if the loan is not dischargeable in bankruptcy, they've got essentially the same lack of incentive to make any judgment about whether to make the loan or not, right? The lack of underwriting. Because at least they can kind of, get that money, but they can kind of keep it on their books because the borrower...
Right, but having it on their books is not necessarily a good... I mean... Of course, you're right that there's still insufficient incentive in these private loans if they're not dischargeable with bankruptcy. And from that, from that perspective, I think like anything we can do to bring the student loan system toward a sort of transparent private market with price signals, I think, is good. But but again, still even with the non-dischargeable loans, there's banks do ultimately want to get paid back, right? It's not just kind of jiggling numbers around on paper. They do want loans that go out to come back in, and the idea
probably,
that that's happening.
I mean,
less
they're called
and less
assets for. I mean, a loan is called an asset for a reason,
Right. Well, I think there are many, many types of student loans that even in a kind of perfect functioning market would still exist. Not to mention, a separate program to subsidize some subset of humans to go to college. That doesn't otherwise totally distort this market. I think there's a case to be made for that. But the idea that somehow we can like require the lenders to like put black outlines around the interest rate on their paperwork and like that's going to fix the system. The system is so far from encouraging people to make good choices. And you say we've made all these strides in the last 10, 20 years. But at the same time, student loan debt is, you know, whatever. It's $1.3 trillion now, right? I mean, it's a huge, huge problem that's getting bigger, not smaller.
It's not a problem. I mean, it's not a problem if people, you know, I mean, your loans aren't necessarily a problem because you have jobs that are you probably wouldn't have.
Right, but people aren't paying it back, right?
I mean, that's... too. Right, but I mean, the sheer amount of, I mean, to the extent that we use that system, which is essentially borrowing ahead on your, you know, it's a kind of a reverse social insurance system. You're borrowing ahead on the gains you will make from education. That's not inherently a terrible system. You know, there are just pieces of it that are problematic. You know, just to, you know, one of my colleagues here, Alex Holt, just a couple days ago, told me about a proposal that he has, and I'll link to it because he's written it up, which seems kind of crazy, which is not to have interest at all on student loans and put everything into the origination fee, so you actually have a very high origination fee. And the nice thing about that is you actually know exactly what your debt is, and it's not, you know, it's not doubling it. As you extend the time that you're paying, it's not building up further. So you really know what you're taking on. If you have any ability to judge future income, you can judge it against that, and you can also make that fit pretty well into an income-based repayment plan.
So, I mean, I'm sure your colleague is very brilliant, but it seems like unlikely that we can reinvent like the system of loans success. I mean, there's a reason that
we have reinvented it. You can't do that system. You couldn't do that in the old system where you were guaranteeing bank loans, but you can do that with a direct lending system, which is what we now have for that part of the system. The private loans that we're talking about are a kind of upper layer beyond that.
Right. I mean, I guess this is like a case of like you can, but should you? Right. Again, I'm just looking for ways to make people's borrowing behavior conform with some relation of their ability to repay, and I don't see that that doing that would encourage that outcome.
Right. Well, all we could do is try to make people try to create the kinds of systems where people can be really smart about the choices they're making about education and income. It's really hard. I mean that's the problem. I mean, it's the problem with both education and healthcare. It's really, really hard for any individual to make consistently smart market type choices based on prices about, you know, the benefits of either, you know, a stent in their artery or a prostate exam or, you know, an associate's degree program in cosmetology.
Right. I mean, it's hard for people to make those choices in education and healthcare precisely because prices in those markets mean almost nothing because they're so heavily interfered with by regulation and state actors,
So you can't say these are areas that aren't subject to price signals.
They're just areas that don't have price signals because of government intervention.
In different ways, people don't see the prices, but even if they did, the ability to say what the I mean, like, you know, obviously, if I want to buy a Bentley, I pretty much know what the, you know, happiness factor or whatever it for me would be in having a Bentley versus the price of a Bentley.
Right.
I can make that assessment for myself. Every day I make and I choose not to buy a Bentley.
there's always tomorrow.
There are probably other cars that I'd be more interested in having anyway. But you know, that's just really not the case when you think about you know, whether it's an associate's degree in cosmetology or a degree from Yale, you know, you just don't really know what the payoff of that is going to be. And there's a lot of mythology about those things. You know, you kind of make assumptions, and sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. It's just not knowable.
Right. I mean, I think, again, we make purchasing decisions and life decisions all the time, even given unknowns in the future. And it's because we do have prices which give us information. I mean, you could say like a trip to, you know, a trip around the world, right? Like, yeah, you know, you're probably going to like it. You don't know how much you're going to like it. You don't know really what it's going to be worth to you. But you know how much an airline ticket around the world costs. I mean, you know, I think, and that price reflects a lot of real inputs and also real demand by other people, right? I mean, that's the other place that we're right now, the whole demand component is basically just completely unknowable because of the way the markets work. So,
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll go shopping for Bentleys together next week, and we'll see how we feel, I guess. But we are out of blogging heads.
We actually need a public Bentley purchasing.
We need a public Bentley subsidy. Okay. Well, next time we do blogging heads, we'll talk about that. But until then, it's been a pleasure, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Nice to talk to you. Okay. Bye bye.